This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to New Books in Medieval History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Evan Zarkadas, your host, and today we will be talking to Dr. Claire Wiede, cultural historian at the Leiden University in Netherlands, to talk about her newest book, Ethnicity in Medieval Europe, 1950-1250, Medicine, Power, and Religion, published in 2021 by the University of York, York Medieval Press. In a new approach to representations of nationhood in medieval Western Europe, Dr. Wiede argues that ethnic stereotypes were constructed and wielded rhetorically to justify things such as property claims, flaunt military strength, and assert moral and cultural ascendance over others. Gendered images of ethnicity in circulation reflect a negotiation over self-representation of discipline, rationality, and strength, juxtaposed with the alleged chaos and weakness of racialized others. In this way, interpreting nationhood through a religious lens, monks and schoolmen explained it as scientifically informed by environmental medicine, an ancient theory that held that location and climate influence the physical and mental traits of peoples. Drawing on a list of ethnic character traits, school textbooks, medical treatises, proverbs, poetry, and chronicles, this book shows that ethnic stereotypes served as rhetorical tools of power, crafting relationships within communities and towards others. Hello, Claire, and welcome to the show.
Hi, and thanks very much for having me and for this invitation to talk about my book.
Absolutely. It's a great pleasure. And as I did this quick summary, it's such a loaded volume with a lot of information, and I'm very glad we get to discuss about it today.
Yeah, it's very exciting.
All right, awesome. So how did you come to write this book? Why medieval ethnicity?
It took me a long time to write it, and I've been working on the topic for a very long period. And I actually started as an undergraduate when I began to read history. And I was planning on doing modern history, but then I sort of got sucked into the period known as the Middle Ages and never really sort of recovered from that. I became really interested in satire, in satirical literature that was being produced in the 12th century in the new universities that were emerging in Europe at that time, in Paris and Bologna. And in southern France. And I was really struck by it was just not what I expected at all, that to find monks and priests, because these are the people who were getting an education at that time, to actually be writing quite salacious poetry and also really poking fun at one another in satirical texts. For instance, Cistercian and Benedictine monks who could write, you know, quite vicious satirical poetry about one another and attacking each other's customs and behavior. So this was really an eye opener to me, because it was just such a different image of the period of the 12th, 13th century than I expected, really, when I first learned about the Middle Ages. You know, the general assumption is that it's a period that's very a period in which not a lot happens, and it's quite apathetic and also unlearned. But so this was a surprise, and that's how I really also became interested in and learned about all kinds of ethnic and racial stereotypes that were circulating in texts in that period. And I think maybe what sparked my interest as well is just the fact that I was myself born in the United Kingdom, but my parents were Dutch. So, and then when I was a teenager, we moved back from England to the Netherlands. And so when I grew up, I was already sort of always sort of used to looking a bit as an outsider at the culture that I was living in. And what I noticed as a teenager was that really both in England and in the Netherlands, people were making the same kind of ethnic jokes about others, and that they were not at all original, nor, I have to say, I usually didn't find them very funny either. And in both countries, they seemed to think that these jokes were that they themselves had come up with these jokes. This made me sort of fascinated, you know, what was going on here. Why were these jokes appealing in certain cultures? I came across similar ethnic banter and rep, but also racial stereotyping in 12th century sources. And I realized that, yeah, it was a topic that hadn't really been researched properly or at all, really. So this became my dissertation topic. I did my PhD at the University of Amsterdam, and then I ended up at Leiden University, where I'm still currently working. And from there on, I also became very interested in medical history, which is, as we'll be talking about, very much tied to these ethnic constructions of identity. And so that's how this book slowly evolved.
Wow, that seems quite the journey.
Absolutely.
Quite a journey.
A long journey.
Yes, and I'm very interested in learning more about and of course reading from your book, all of this, you know, use of this kind of language and ethnicity and identity. You know, it's always so interesting to see how these things come to be. As you mentioned, even carry on through today. That origin, quite a lot there. So let us dive into the book a little bit then. So you split the book in two parts, and the first talks about what binds ethnic groups in learned texts, and you chose 950 to 1250, and then you analyze ideas about characteristics of ethnic groups, and as you mentioned, you talk about monastic lists, scientifically informed texts, and then you move on to military manuals. So first, for somebody that does not know what medieval ethnicity means in this period, what does that entail, having ethnicity or the idea of ethnicity in this period?
Yeah. So in medieval texts from Europe in this period, there's a constant mention of ethnic groups. So they're called usually in the sources in Latin, gentes, which is the plural of gens, people, or naciones, a plural of natio, nations. And you'll come across them in, for instance, most chronicles. There are chronicles written about the gentes Anglicorum or the gentes Franco, etc. So it's a very common term. And in some cases also authors from the period itself define what they think ethnicity is. And they talk about it in terms of having a shared descent, a lineage, a common culture, for instance. And it's sometimes tied to territories where these groups were dwelling. But it's important to realize that the actual groups themselves are fluid, and they can emerge in the sources, but they can also retreat from them. And the ethnonyms, so the names applied to these groups, can also, for instance, change or refer to people populating different regions. So there isn't one ethnic group that emerges in, for instance, the 6th century and then just, you know, continues to reproduce itself across the centuries. For instance, the Franks in northern France, that there isn't one long tradition that they evolve into the French and then nowadays we have France. It's much more fluid. And a lot of these gentes are no longer groups that we talk about today. So instead of trying to pinpoint who these groups exactly were, or how they emerged or who identified with them, I think it's useful and important to look really at how they were talked about, which is basically communication by contemporaries, and what kind of discourses or ideas were feeding into how they were being talked about. And by that I mean, for instance, religious ideas, or for instance, scientific ideas. So ideas about how groups emerge and what the qualities or traits of group members would be. Because it turned out that in scientific thought in the 12th century, but also in earlier periods, they did have actually quite specific ideas about the traits of groups. And then I think it's relevant to also to look at what purposes ethnic representations or ethnotypes can have. So they can, for instance, they can help for people to bond in social relations, for instance, by making jokes among themselves. But they can also, especially when certain group members are talking about other group members in a hierarchy, be used, for instance, to distribute rights, to make claims to property. And in the latter case, we're talking more about racial stereotypes than ethnic stereotypes. So I make a distinction between the two. So I began sort of exploring the underlying ideas about what shapes group characteristics in the period 950 to 1250. And it became clear to me that there were sort of two major strands of thought that were related to one another in this period. And then firstly, in the earlier period, so around 950, you mostly see listings of ethnic characteristics. And these are all, I have to emphasize, so they are characteristics that are being talked about in the sources themselves, but they are representations that are not embedded mostly in actual behavioral realities. They are ethnic and racial stereotypes. But just so you see these genealogical constructions of descent and then traits that are attributed to these lineages on the one hand. And then especially more so from about 1100 onwards, you see that group characteristics, so talking about the physical and mental features of groups, is considered to be determined also by places and environment. And the latter becomes particularly explicit when texts are translated from Arabic and Greek into Latin and then into vernacular languages, and more increasingly studied at the emerging universities, the centers of learning in the 12th century in Western Europe. This doesn't mean to say that the idea that environment shaped ethnic traits was completely absent in earlier periods. But because these universities emerge in the 12th century and their intellectuals come together to study medical texts, to study works of natural philosophy, they do begin to write about it much more and much more consciously. So you do see in a sort of explosion of texts in that period about this topic. And then also in the educational sphere, textbooks of rhetoric, so advising students how to write, how to write poetry, how to describe, and also, for instance, how to describe other people, so in ethnography, use ethnic stereotypes in their manuals, explaining how, if you want to write convincingly, you should talk about the essential characteristics of groups. So it's stereotyping was considered in education in that period as a sort of central component of successfully describing phenomena in the world. So that's how I came to my sort of threefold division, the first part of the book, looking at first lists produced in a monastic context from 950 to the 12th century that talk about ethnic traits. And they do so mostly it's called the translation concept. So they begin with peoples living in the East and also peoples that are considered to be in the history of mankind to be the peoples of the past. And they move throughout time and space from East to West, ending up with, for instance, listing traits of the Picts, the Scots, etc. And from this Western European perspective, that is sort of the present. This is the way that history and the history of humanity from this Western Christian perspective has sort of traveled from East to West and from the past to the present, which is, in their view, Christianity. And then from the 12th century, you see more and more that environment and place becomes important, especially in ethnographic descriptions. And then also increasingly for instance, sources are talking about the characteristics of army recruits. So who's equipped, well-equipped to defend a territory, defend a domesticated space, and specifically in the context of labor and who has the rights to the fruits of labor. And you see in that sense that ethnicity and stereotypes are used particularly in colonization efforts. So for instance, in the 12th century, Ireland is colonized by the Anglo-Normans, and there's a lot of ethnography that's being produced saying that the Irish have all kinds of traits of laziness, a less developed urban, social and political structure. And this is a justification for these Anglo-Normans to go in there and say, okay, we're here to create order. We're here to make sure that the territory where these people are dwelling is going to be tilled, you know, worked properly to reap the highest, you know, productive benefits from this land. So these are very much rhetorical arguments that are being made about property, power, security. They're not it's not just ethnic banter jokes among people among themselves, you know, having fun and just poking fun. There's actually a lot going on with these stereotypes.
There is. There definitely is. But you were just describing this in a very quick way. I think it's, again, such a loaded question of what is an ethnic group. And as you mentioned, I'm interested in this aspect of the university playing a big role in this. As you mentioned, that you have these new institutions raising up in Europe again. And so they have a big effect on how these names and ethnonyms and these perceptions of others actually play. Correct. So I think they have a big influence.
Absolutely. There is a caveat because the universities are the places where learned people, and these are priests, were able to study and also so produce the texts that have survived. So unfortunately, we have much less examples of you know, what's being talked about in the streets, etc. So we can't research that because we don't have, we simply just don't have the material to research it. So there's always a sort of skewed aspect to, because we're looking at, you know, we're looking at what survived, and this is what is being produced by these learned people. But absolutely, so in the 12th century, universities begin to appear, often also supported by centers of power, such as, for instance, the French monarchy in Paris. And there, the young men, because that's who they were, studied, for instance, they studied the Artis Liberalis program, so they studied rhetoric and grammar and all that kind of stuff. But then they went on to also study law and medicine and theology. And they were hugely excited and concentrate on the new texts that are available to them, which are translations from the Greco and Arabic scientific world of natural philosophical texts. And particularly Aristotle becomes incredibly important in the 13th century, but also all kinds of medical texts, but also in the fields of geometry, and so sort of the natural philosophical field. And they write a lot of commentaries about this, and it has a huge impulse, it has a huge impact on the development of scholastic thought in this period. And they also, in the 12th and 13th century, begin to produce a lot of regimens. So these are sort of manuals of conduct on how students, for instance, should behave themselves, but also how household members should behave, how rulers, how princes should behave, but also advising how to rule, how to govern your household, how to govern your city, etc. And these regimens are also very much influenced by this Greco and Arabic thought. And in both these kind of texts, the idea that ethnicity, that groups are determined by the environment and place where they come from, where they dwell, is present. And this has to do with the ancient Greek theory of climate that was first developed by Hippocrates. So more than 2,000 years ago in Airs, Waters, Places, Hippocrates, who was a physician, wrote that characteristics of human beings are determined to a large extent by the terrain where people live, but also the climate in which they dwell. So, for instance, if you're living in a cold climate, you would be naturally more bold and rash. And if you're dwelling in a hot climate, you would be naturally more intelligent, but also fearful and cunning, because you would be afraid to lose too much blood because of the heat. And this idea that environment and climate determines both your physical and your mental qualities or capacities was used by Aristotle, for instance, in his Politics, when he's talking about natural slavery, to say that certain groups dwelling in certain territories are therefore more predestined to dwell with certain forms of governance. So, for instance, if you are a southern type and you're quite fearful, then it's better to have a sort of authoritative regime that tells you what to do. And the people in the north, the rash people, also had to be who were more freedom loving. So you had to take that into account. But so these, there are various sort of political forms of governance that Aristotle relates to climate and environment. And this is an argument that later in the development of slavery was very helpful to justify slavery, to say, well, look, certain groups of people are destined to take on a role as being a servant rather than a master because of the natural environment and therefore their sort of hereditary features. So these ideas, especially from the 12th century, become more, they're studied more, they're talked about more in texts that are produced in Western Europe once these Greek and Arabic texts are translated via Spain and Sicily and Byzantium and become available also in in Northern Europe. And these are also picked up on by courts, by rulers, because they obviously would, you know, this is valuable information. It's valuable information to have, for instance, ethnography produced when you are colonizing a region to know, you know, what kind of people are allegedly living there, but also to be able to support your own claims when you are trying to conquer a territory and to justify that. So the men who study at the universities often also went on to work in these courts, took these ideas with them. And for rulers, this was important, valuable sort of intelligence, but also justification for what they were doing, especially also in the Crusades. Yeah.
We'll get to that in a minute. But how widespread were these? So we're talking about scholars studying them on universities, but what happens in the society, in the community? Does anything change, or are things different before these ideas resurface? Do we know anything about that?
So this is a difficult question to answer, which has to do with what I just mentioned, that, you know, we work as a historians with the texts that have survived, and these are very often produced by an elite. So it's always hard to make statements about, you know, what you can't research. I did do my best to try and work out how widespread they were, and you do see that these stereotypes, so the contents of the actual stereotypes, are very widespread. So the Franks could be saying something about the Anglo-Saxons, and German writers would be responding to the same kind of stereotype. So in that sense, I think they were circulating quite broadly. But then again, the universities and the schools in this period were very international. Students came from all over Europe to study in Paris. So in that sense, it's not that strange that they were using the same type of images. I also looked at proverbs, and there you do also see, to a certain extent, the same type of images circulating. This can suggest that they are, that this is a sort of banter that is more widespread also than what intellectuals are saying. But I can't really go much farther than that, because I simply just don't have the material. So my focus has really been on the centers of power, the centers of knowledge, the courts, and how they have been talking about ethnic groups and what it's done in for their, you know, claims to power in colonization movements, etc.
Yeah, I think that's the same case throughout history for most of the case, that, you know, it is this elite that we study in many documents, as you mentioned. So my big takeaway from this book was this idea of environmental determinism. As you mentioned, environment affecting both your character, but also your physical characteristics. And, you know, it sounds so Atlantish if you actually say that to somebody in today's world, that, you know, your environment will actually affect you in so many ways. And it's just such an interesting concept. So you said it originates from the Greco-Arabic world, and I think on your book you talk about the humoral theory or approach. It's just fascinating to really think that environment, people thought that environment actually, you know, cultivates you as a human.
When sources from antiquity, but also in the medieval period, talking about environment, it's almost difficult to distinguish sometimes between what they consider environment and what they consider culture. It's one slides into another. So the location where a person is dwelling, you know, the surroundings, whether you're not you're living on a mountain or on a plain, whether you're in a green environment or in a dry environment. The way that people use the environment and have practices and cultural customs related to the environment, also eating and drinking customs, you know, what they take from the environment is very much interconnected with one another. And so it almost seems that for that culture and environment are sort of, yeah, they slide into one another. Humoral theory, which you just mentioned, is a sort of substrand of environmental theory. So Hippocrates in the 4th century before BCE, he talked about, you know, how environment and places would shape features of peoples. Galen, a physician in the 2nd century CE, he wrote a huge number of medical texts in which he sort of really developed this idea of the humours, the four sort of their bodily fluids, and combinations of these bodily fluids together determine what a person's complexion would be. And these are fluids of they can be melancholy, they can be sanguine, which is a sort of blood. They can be phlegmatic, and they can be choleric. And together, the combination of the balance of these fluids make up your complexion. And this complexion has a huge impact on, for instance, your mental features. So if you're hot-headed, you're more likely to be sort of a choleric type than if you are melancholy, which is, an image that we still understand today. Humoral theory is also used to talk about ethnic groups, especially from the 13th century, but especially in talking about pathologizing actually what happens to groups after, from a Christian perspective, the fall of mankind occurs. So according to Christian theology, so Adam and Eve, you know, the first two people were indwelling in Eden, and they were having a wonderful time, and there was no ill health, there was no disease, but then there was the snake, and etc. Eve, you know, she gets she entices Adam, and so they get kicked out of paradise, and paradise is environmentally perfect place, also not too hot, not too cold, and then once they're kicked out of paradise, their bodies become corrupt. And the worst kind of corruption that actually sets in is the melancholy corruption. And this idea that some bodies become particularly melancholy is then tied to specific lineages. And these lineages are the Jewish people, also talking about women, and for instance, talking about serfs, so talking about people who sort of, you know, semi-unfree laborers. And these people, so Jews and serfs, for instance, are then considered to have melancholy bodies in some medical texts. And this is also a way of gendering these ethnic groups to say, because they're also, so for instance, in 13th century scientific texts, some of them say that Jews actually menstruate also, which is a result of the corruption of their bodies, like women. And so it's also a way of talking in gendered terms about sort of effeminacy, their weakness, if you're working from a sort of male rational perspective of having to be strong. Again, it's a way of othering, using medical science in that period to talk about different kinds of groups, to talk about them in terms of heredity, also in terms of religious. So they're religious constructions of cursed lineages that have become hereditary according to these texts, and it's also a way of organizing labor. So it's organizing the division of labor. So for instance, also serfs are talked about being melancholy in some cases, they are have corrupted bodies. And these groups, serfs, women, Jews, are also have less rights in some legal, have a different legal status. So it's science is being used here to it's not just talking about health in the sense of how we're going to cure people, but it's also talking about health to make a distinction between, to create categories. And you see that humoral theory, for instance, is also used in educational texts from this period, talking about the the qualities, the intellectual capacities of students, of pupils in the classroom, saying, you know, some are more intelligent than others, some are more melancholy than others, the youth is more sanguine. That means that they're you know, very healthy and in good spirits, but perhaps, you know, slightly less inclined to pay attention in class. So you see here also, you know, these are sort of also sort of psychological frameworks that are being used to talk about how through education certain groups are, you know, destined to take on certain roles in society, and others are destined to do perhaps more manual labor and not intellectual labor. So there's science in that sense is a very important it's a very important lens to use to look at how ethnicity is being constructed in this period, long way before 18th century scientific racism. I think that scientific racism has a very long history that is not properly understood at the moment.
Yeah, it just seems like that, you know, things are piling up to lead to this distinction of peoples by these scholars, students that were studying these. And I think it's interesting how, you know, religious thoughts took on that and used some of this and probably reframed and reinterpreted certain of these ideas from the past, and they kind of took a new form and then piled on to each other, I guess, to come up with this distinctions in many ways.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's very entangled religious constructions also of virtues and vices, and medical constructions of mental qualities, what's bad for you, what's good for you, and also the language that they use to talk about these things. So both in religion and in medicine, they'll, for instance, use the term spiritus. And it's sometimes really hard because the people producing these learned texts are, men of the church or monks who are they're the intellectuals who are well versed in natural philosophy. So the two worlds are one. Where does religion stop and science start? That could be really hard to distinguish in this period. What you do see in religious thought is the idea of thinking in genealogies and thinking of biblical which ethnic groups are the inheritors of biblical lineages is very present, and then that becomes also medically interpreted.
And on practice we see this. I like to study the East, so reading your book, it was really interesting to see this West, East, North, South, as you said, past to present. Distinctions, and since we're talking about Western Europe, you know, they're always presented as, you know, more powerful, more fit in many ways than, you know, the people that they're seeing as the other. And the concept of the other is also really important in this, because with these methods and theories, you're othering others from your own group for a particular purpose and reason and goal.
Yeah. These are very much sort of self-representations that you do in some cases see self-representations in which are also negative. So it's not just, for instance, Westerners only saying, okay, we're manly, strong, disciplined, and other people are, but they are often mirror images. And it's a way of, you know, distinguishing yourself from others, because ethnicity is very relational. It has to do with maintaining boundaries, and you have to create these boundaries somehow. And using these images is one way of doing so. And they can be very ethnocentric, and then depending on within Christianity, you'll have a lot of this mirroring going on. You know, you'll have Anglo-Saxons saying terrible things about pigs, and you'll have Germans saying all kinds of stuff about Norwegians, etc. Well, they don't use the term Norwegian, but it's not just interreligious, it's also within Christendom, but then also it is talking about Muslims, talking about Jews. And so you always have to really bear in mind how the, you know, what is the social and economic framework in which these discussions, this banter, or these, you know, very serious slurs are being made. Is that, you know, is it a very hierarchical relationship that's going on because then it's more racial? Or is it, for instance, you know, when clerics in the University of Paris, who are all from a sort of the same background and have the same legal status as clergymen, are joking among themselves, yeah, then it's more ethnic banter. And then it's less racial, I would say.
Yeah, and I think that's a great segue to the First Crusade, because you do mention it in your book. And I think how I read it, at least, is that it was a great way for some of these theories to be tested, to put into test, and to exercise some of these ideas into actual, you know, colonization and moving to the East, to, in many ways, the past. And you have this religions component as well. And yeah, talk to us a little bit about that, your take on the First Crusade and the use of this ethnic mentality.
Yeah, so what really struck me is, so in some of the sources talking about the First Crusade, and there are some very famous chronicles that have written extensively about the First Crusade, the people producing them are sometimes monks who themselves actually have never set foot in Palestine. So they're writing about all these battles and everything that's going on, but they're writing from their monastic cells in Western Europe. And for instance, someone like William of Malmesbury, who was a very intellectual, very clever historian, he wrote, you know, he produced his chronicles from England. And so he uses environmental theory to really talk about the traits of the Saracen or Turkish fighters, really talking about that they, because they are Easterners, that they were less brave and they were cunning, but they weren't, so they weren't really equipped for warfare, and hence this explains why, especially the French, the Franks, were victorious. So in that sense, you see that this whole environmental intellectual theoretical framework is used to explain how certain parties are winning. Whereas if you actually look at sources describing the relationships between the different contingents on this crusade, you'll see that there's a lot of intergroup arguing and rude things that are being said all along, in which the Franks are very good at sort of claiming for themselves this position of being the best equipped fighters fighting in God's cause. So the Franks are very good at saying we are that we're the chosen people, we're the destined people on this course to conquer Palestine, and this is very important in an eschatological narrative also of conquering Palestine, so that in the end days that Christ can return to earth, and there'll be and a sort of apocalyptic war, and then so that's very much a part of it. So there you see that the relational aspect of ethnicity is very strong, in the sense that it's a Christian army with different contingent who are fighting alongside one another, but in a lot of the time they are really competing with one another on who is the best Christian warrior. So it's highly competitive. But then there are certain moments when there are, you know, large battles, and then it really turns into a Christian narrative of who has, you know, God on his side, and that they are fighting a just battle, and that's why they've conquered Jerusalem, etc. So yeah, you see again ideas of religion and science really intermingling when talking about who's equipped not only to defend your own domesticated space, your own territory, but also who's equipped to fight on God's side, as which would be for Christians, it would be, for instance, the Franks, who would make this claim.
Yeah, yeah. And that's where I think you mentioned a few military manuals as well, because we mentioned, you know, the religious aspect, the medicine aspect, and then there is this military approach as
yes,
well.
Yes, there's a wonderful, very important source, De Re Militari by Fagetius, who was a 4th, 5th century military strategist who wrote a manual on how to lead your army. It's a source that's not explored that much, but it was very important in the period. There are hundreds and hundreds of manuscripts that have survived. And it was very, you know, it was important for courts and for rulers, because fighting was an important daily business in a lot of cases of these courts, and there's constant strife going on. And this manual, not only so it uses environmental theory to a strong extent, because if there's one area in which public health and medicine is important, it is in the military. If you have armies, it's so important. If you're on a campaign, it's so important to factor in the environment where you are, that you are dealing with, you know, how you have access to clean water, what you do for sanitation, because the threat of your army perishing from an epidemic is actually larger than being killed in battle. So if there's one area in which medicine was developed throughout the centuries, it is in the army. So you see a lot of this medicine and environmental theory in Fagetius, but he also uses it to write about which armies, which recruits are best equipped to fight the battles. And then this is used to talk about which ethnic groups are best equipped to fight battles.
Yeah. I can talk about this for a long, long time. But one thing I will say is that it was kind of enlightening to read your book, because we kind of see kind of this Western approach in this, all of these theories. But then I studied a little bit later the Fourth Crusade and more like the 13th, the 14th century. And some of these things actually do carry on still in those times with the Frankish states, and There is some of that still carrying on very strongly, actually.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, because I only studied, you know, a couple of centuries and only Western Europe, and it was more than enough for me. But I think there's still a lot of work to be done on other regions, other periods, and how these ideas develop, and also, for instance, resisted. And adapted, because this is one thing that I unfortunately wasn't able to study enough in my book. I'm talking about discourses, and I'm talking about these ideas that are circulating and these images that are circulating. But this doesn't mean to say that people were locked in this sort of mental world in which they were constantly behaving amongst themselves, you know, in social relations, one of the locked in these ideas. There are, you know, a lot of cases in which people can resist ethnic stereotypes or racial stereotypes, or just don't find them actually that appealing, or they're not working to their in their own life worlds to their own advantage, or they just don't believe in them, or etc. So I think that's very important to mention. And also that, you know, it's not set in stone. These ideas adapt because what happens at universities changes, what happens in social economic relationships changes, etc. So I think it would be very beneficial to look at how these ideas, for instance, also in other regions were used, and maybe in a different way, to get a proper understanding of how science, religion intersects when we're talking about ethnicity.
Yeah, the more I study ethnicity in medieval Europe, the more confused I get. But the amount of complexity and just the whole idea and development of ethnicity in medieval Europe is such an intriguing concept, because there's so much content into it.
Yeah.
What surprised you the most while conducting your research?
What surprised me was actually when I was compiling the index for my book. So at the end, and I was just listing the stereotypes per ethnic group, and just the also the sheer nastiness of a lot of the stuff that was being saying. It actually quite sickened me. And I hadn't, I mean, I knew that all this stuff was being said and was going on, but once you sort of start to list it for an index, then it really sort of sticks out. And also the number of comparisons between ethnic groups and animals. And this isn't, it's not just dehumanizing, it's a way also, again, of organizing labor and property rights, because if you say that a certain ethnic group, for instance, take again the example of the Irish, who are sometimes in Anglo-Norman sources also compared to beasts, or the Welsh are compared to beasts, it's a way of stripping them of certain rights, claims, you know, historical claims to the territory where they're dwelling, claims to the efforts that have been made through their labor to reaping the benefits of their labor. And I was really struck by how often this is actually happening. And I thought it was quite shocking to see.
Yeah, it's quite a lengthy index as well, with a lot of these descriptions. And I was just thinking while I was sending you the invitation for this podcast that you need a whole podcast series just to talk about all of this content in your book, as it's so lengthy. Great. So where do you see the topic of medieval ethnicity developing in the future, and what are we still missing from research?
Yes, so that's a very good question. I think the most important, most fruitful way to look at it is to really see how racial capitalism is... looks at how social and economic value is extracted from bodies in a capitalist system. And I think there is a strong intersection with Galenic thought, so with medical Galenic thought, which developed especially in the 14th and 15th century while capitalist markets were also emerging in Western Europe, because Galenic thought really works with the idea that the body of individuals correlates in a certain way with the body politic, with the society in which a person dwells. And there's a whole discourse in the 14th and 15th century about able-bodiedness. So who is able-bodied enough to work and therefore not have access to certain support, for instance, to charity, for instance. And at the same time, you see, especially after the Black Death in the 14th century, so after the big plague outbreak, that there's a lot of social mobility, there's a lot of movement, there's a lot of people are moving from rural areas to towns, but there's also a lot of increasing poverty levels, increasing groups of people who don't have access to means of sustenance themselves, and are really sort of in the hands of the labor markets. And so how medicine is involved in organizing these labor markets, and how that is really, I think it's very close to racial capitalism, I think is something that hasn't been explored and is very worthwhile exploring, because it helps us to understand how norms, representations, ideas about bodies or about able-bodiedness, and practices, how they intersect. And looking at the medical world is a helpful way to understand this, because the physicians and surgeons, they produce ethnographic descriptions, they write treatises about bodies and minds, but they also work in practice with people who are laboring. They care for them, they treat them, they sometimes also value them, for instance, in slave trade in the 14th, not only in Europe, but also in the Mamluk world. There's an excellent book by Hanan Barker, That Most Precious Merchandise, which discusses how in the Mamluk world, physicians produced manuals how to appraise a slave, how to work out its value based on all kinds of ethnic and bodily and facial features. So you see physicians both, you know, talking normatively, talking, producing intellectual treatises, but also in practice working with bodies of people and determining, extracting social and economic value. So I think there's a lot of work to be done in this area. And then also comparatively, obviously, looking beyond Europe, looking at how other regions organized labor along these lines.
Yeah, those would definitely be, I think there, as you mentioned, there medieval ethnicity, it's just a topic that it's kept standing on. And I think your approach, I mean, to medicine and looking at these physicians, as you mentioned, and then affecting multiple sects of the society, yeah, that would be quite an interesting, hopefully, future research that we might be able to see.
Yeah, that would be fantastic.
Well, great, Claire. I think we've taken a lot of your time, and I thank you for that. I would like to ask you one last question before you go. What are you up to nowadays? Any interesting projects in the works?
Well, so I'm. You might not be surprised that I am actually working on what I just talked about, so Hellenic medicine and racial capitalism. But I'm focusing particularly on two groups, on armies and naval recruits. So people working on ships and people working in armies. And this is it's super, I think, interesting because you can. These are two groups that have a lot of documentation on how they were cared for, the food that they received, the shelter that they received, but also the injuries that they received, etc., the wages that they received. So it's a way to get much closer to actual practices than what I've done previously. So for me, that's really exciting.
No, that's great. It's nice. Yes, you talked about what's needed and now you're working toward what's filling the fulfillment. I think that's amazing.
That's great.
Well, Claire, yes, that sounds great. Thank you once again very much for being on the show today. I really enjoyed our conversation and I hope we had another 3 hours to talk about these things. But thank you so much and take care.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.